Several days ago, I reported on an incredible story, a sensational find in the Egyptian desert of a long-lost Gospel of Judas, offering still another version of the most notorious biblical betrayal that Jesus asked Judas to turn him over to be crucified. Judas may be the good guy. Is it all true? In a moment, we're going to be talking with an expert, Dr. Ken Hansen, about this, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and some other issues right here on Coast to Coast AM. The New York Times is reporting tonight that when the National Geographic Society announced to great fanfare last week that it had gained access to a 1,700-year-old document known as the Gospel of Judas, it described how a deteriorating manuscript unearthed in Egypt 3 decades ago had made its way through the shady alleys of Antiquities Market to a safe deposit box on Long Island and eventually to a Swiss art dealer who rescued it from obscurity. But, as the Times reports, there's even more to the story. The art dealer was detained several years ago in an unrelated Italian antiquity smuggling investigation. And after she failed to profit from the sale of the gospel in the private market, she struck a deal with a foundation run by her lawyer that would let her make about as much as she would have made on that sale or more. Later, the National Geographic Society paid the foundation to restore the manuscript and bought the rights to the text and story about the discovery. As part of her arrangement with the foundation, the dealer stands to gain $1 to $2 million from those National Geographic projects, and maybe more. But no one is, by the way, questioning the authenticity of the Judas Gospel, which depicts Judas Iscariot not as a betrayer of Judas, of Jesus, but as his favored disciple. Now, Dr. Ken Hansen is an author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in a politically volatile region of northern Galilee, and taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement. He was also working with a television news gathering operation in a war zone in southern Iran and southern Lebanon at the height of the civil war that left the jewel of the Mediterranean in ruins. Having been up close and personal with the face of terrorism, Dr. Hansen lends a timeless perspective to the challenges of the future. Currently serving at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, where he teaches courses on Jewish history from ancient times through the 20th century, including the rise of Israel and the Holocaust. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Ken. How are you? Welcome back.
Doing great, George. Good to be with you.
You too. This story, the Gospel of Judas, where nobody's really questioning its authenticity, is an incredible story, but it's been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, the text itself has. It is more than amazing. I've worked with ancient texts for decades now, and you reach a point where you really think just about everything that could be found has been found. And people always ask, is it possible that some other manuscript that we didn't know about might still be out there and might still surface? And I kind of chuckle and say, well, yes, anything's possible, but really inside very much doubting it. And what happens? What happens? Out of nowhere, literally, we have the surfacing of a 1,700-year-old document. And while there's all manner of intrigue connected with it, as you rightly point out, nonetheless, there's no question that the document itself is authentic. It is that old, and it's remarkable, out of the blue.
Does it vindicate Judas, or does it merely confuse the issue again?
Well, I think the issue has always been confused and will remain confused. I've been a little bit of a fan of Judas, I might add, secretly. I don't like the idea of dumping on one character in the biblical text and saying this person is now to be villainized. It's kind of refreshing, as a matter of fact, to read this text. I think that people are going to have to reevaluate this very fascinating character who has been terribly misunderstood down through the ages.
Now, why or how was Judas fingered for getting Christ crucified in the first place?
The story is told in the traditional Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that here we have a disciple who secretly connived in cahoots with the Romans and with the religious Jewish leaders of the day to betray Jesus, to turn him over as an agitator, as a troublemaker, in return for some money. And we all know about the 30 pieces of silver that he received.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the great betrayal. It's interesting that we're talking about it on this night. This is the night of the Jewish Passover, as a matter of fact. And that was precisely the night when, in the traditional gospel account, Judas betrayed Jesus. Jesus had the Passover meal with his disciples. He went out to the famous Garden of Gethsemane, and that is the point where he is arrested by the Roman authorities. Judas is responsible, so the original Gospels tell us.
Is it possible that those Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John truly believed that Judas betrayed Jesus, that maybe they weren't informed that this was an arranged situation?
But it does look as though there's something arranged when we read the text itself. In John's gospel, as a matter of fact, Jesus looks at Judas and he says, "What you do, do quickly." It sounds as though, reading between the lines, that in fact, even the traditional accounts suggest that something might have been arranged here. The question is why. We also have to bear in mind that in the ancient world, there was no such thing as a single Christianity. Now, this shocks people. When Christianity developed, it developed slowly, and there was no orthodoxy. There was no single Christian church. There was no Christianity. There were Christianities, and the scholarly world is increasingly aware of that roaring fact. Nobody had one single idea about anything. It was all a matter of stories that came down, of traditions that were recounted, and then subsequent editors trying to piece it all together and put it all together, this tradition here, that tradition there, and everybody disagreeing, and different groups having profoundly different ideologies and theologies. It was a big cauldron, a big mix.
The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were they physically written by, and have they been obtained by us now, by these individuals, or were they written by other people based on the stories they believe they were told?
There's endless scholarly research regarding Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, especially the three synoptics, as they're called, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which came down to us in Greek, and yet there's some very good scholarship going on in the Middle East, in the land of Israel, and interestingly enough, by Jewish scholars who are fascinated with the historical Jesus. Can we find the real Jesus of history through all of the folklore and all of the stories and all of the theology? Can we find this man? And they're looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke in the Greek, and they're saying this looks to us very much like it was translated from some earlier missing source, probably in either Aramaic or, in fact, Hebrew, a missing gospel of Jesus. We don't know who wrote this. We have no idea. It was subsequently translated to Greek, and then the Greek was retranslated and then split up. And what we call Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we really don't have much of a clue as to who finally put them together at the very end of the day.
Could it have been put together, Ken, by a great storyteller? I mean, we look at great scripts here in Hollywood, and you wonder, well, are they real, or did someone make that up? And then you watch the movie, you know, by just watching it, what happened here, what the direction of the script was. Is it possible that whoever wrote these stories down after years just made up some of the things?
Well, as a scholar, I have to hedge my bets and say, yeah, that is possible. I know that is profoundly disappointing to a lot of folks out there who like to take these as verbatim, literal accounts. But when you can't prove it, when you can't demonstrate it for sure, you have to back off a little bit and say, you know, yeah, as a matter of fact, there's not a text that we have that has not been edited by an editorial hand. And whenever somebody edits a text, they're thinking, now, who is the readership here? Who is my audience?
Absolutely.
As a writer myself, I know this rule. Who is my audience? And you've got to frame a story in a compelling way. And sometimes, let's not say that they're lying, but sometimes they're selectively depicting the story the way they want, using the facts that they want. And some traditions are ignored entirely. What we've got in the Gospel of Judas is a compelling reference that there might in fact have been a very ancient tradition going back at least as far as the second century of the Common Era. That's very early, very close to the life of Jesus himself. We've got an ancient tradition ignored by the other Gospels, but now here it is that Jesus in fact had some kind of special relationship with Judas that he did not have with the others. A very close, intimate, special relationship that he shared things with Judas, that he taught Judas mystical teachings that he did not share with anybody else, and one of those had to do with his impending execution, that he knew this had to happen, and to that extent, Judas was commissioned. This is amazing.
Do you think that the, because I'm trying to set the scene for this before we go back to the Gospel of Judas, do you think that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John might then have been written by one person or four people or a number of people?
Okay, it's a little complicated.
Based on what they think they heard.
Yeah, my feeling is that we have a missing undertext, let's call it, in a Semitic language, either Aramaic or, in fact, likely Hebrew,
okay,
that was probably put down by a single hand. And then that text was copied and translated into Greek. And then that Greek text was split up. And at that point, we've got several hands. We've got several editorial hands, but it all goes back to some early and missing document, a biography, probably by one hand.
It could have been one of the disciples who
it
might
could,
have been the
author.
It
could, in fact, have been. And by the way, this is a bit off the subject, but my own feeling is that there were not 12. Judas was one of the 12. My own feeling is that there was a 13th. The beloved disciple who is introduced in our traditional Gospels, who is separate from any of the others, and was, in fact, the 13th and extremely close disciple.
All right, we'll talk about that, too, tonight. Now, then, the Gospel of Judas, if you assume that the original writings were done by one person before they went in, you know, they were written in Greek and then moved along, is it possible then to assume that the Gospel of Judas, it also was written by that same person in the beginning?
That's harder to say. It looks like that the text that has come down to us, that has really just surfaced amazingly in the last, week officially,
right,
this is a Coptic text that goes back to an original Greek source. This happens a lot, where a text will get translated to another language, then the original lost. In this case, we've got Coptic, which is sort of an Egyptian language that was translated from an earlier Greek manuscript. The Greek is lost. So we're not looking necessarily at an original Hebrew or Aramaic or Semitic source, but a Greek source that probably came out of a whole group of early Christians. Again, there were Christianities in the plural, the Gnostics. Gnostic Christianity, which was a huge, huge block of ancient Christendom in those days, and different groups among the Gnostics. There was one very interesting and mysterious group known as the Cainites, who apparently decided that some of the evil characters in the Bible we shouldn't really look at as so terribly devious and evil. For example, Cain, who killed his brother Abel. That was the first murder in the Bible. And Judas. Maybe these people we can look at, in fact, as heroes in a way. And they called themselves the Cainites. They were a group of Gnostic Christians who lived a little bit further to the west than the rest of the Palestinian Jewish Christians in the land of Israel, a separate group entirely, who had their own traditions. And yet here we've got a tradition about Judas that again, is compellingly ancient.
What year did those Cainites live?
We're talking the first couple of centuries of the Common Era, right in the formative period of Christianity.
So that
would
be... Would that be B.C.?
No. This is A.D. We in the academic world, we call it Common Era or C.E. We're a little politically correct, but it's the same as A.D.
Well, I guess I was talking about the Cain portion. What year might we have been talking about there? Cain and Abel, of course, being the descendants of Adam and Eve.
Right.
Obviously, they wouldn't be in the A.D. version.
Well, okay, but these people lived in the A.D. period. But these stories, going back to the very earliest patriarchs, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, continued to float around. So these people just picked up those stories and said...
Yeah, no, those people, I agree, lived in the A.D. period. But I mean...
They called themselves the Cainites.
If one had to give a time period to the existence of Abel and Cain, for example, when do you think that would be? That would be B.C., but what period?
That depends when you place Adam and Eve, assuming there were an Adam and Eve historically. The very cradle of civilization going way back to ancient Babylonia and maybe before that. We get into a different topic there. How old is humanity?
What does Ken Hansen think? 3,000 B.C.? 4,000? 5,000?
Yeah, easily 3,000. I have to hedge my bets. I'm open-minded. Show me more evidence about 5,000, and I'll believe you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the Gospel of Judas, what exactly, Ken, is it?
We've got papyrus manuscripts, essentially, found in a cave, believe it or not, in Egypt, near a place called El Minya, in a cavern by a farmer. Back in the 1970s. This is the kind of thing that comes out of a Indiana Jones movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yet, you know, what they say, you know, truth being stranger than fiction, you could not make this up. This farmer finds it in Egypt. The thing floats around in the antiquities market through a lot of intrigue, makes it to several different countries, including the United States, where it sits in a safe deposit box for years and years before it finally goes on to Zurich, Switzerland, and as you mentioned, the entire intrigue involving now the National Geographic Society, but originally discovered out of nowhere, out of the blue, in the 1970s, that long ago, and it took all this time for it to wend its way from a shoebox to a safe deposit box to various hands and finally get into the hands through Yale universities and National Geographic Society of people who can properly piece the thing together. And that work has been going on for several years now. It's only within the last week that it's finally been in a condition of being unveiled as a complete document because the papyrus itself was so brittle, it was in such a bad condition, just to touch it, it would crumble into pieces, very much like Dead Sea Scroll material, which also ended up in thousands of little tiny pieces. You have to put this together as the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle.
If the gospel is accurate, and Judas was a friend of Jesus, and that Jesus and Judas somehow conspired to put this crucifixion together, that Judas had to go and turn him in order for it to occur, doesn't that damper a little bit the story of Jesus and the crucifixion and the reasons why he was crucified?
Well, a good story needs a foil, needs a hero. It also needs a villain. And as you mentioned, the later editors who set down the synoptic gospels as we traditionally have them certainly like to play on the hero-villain. The hero and the foil. You go to a movie and you want a villain that you can really hate so that when that villain, when that heavy goes down, you're cheering. And that's what you want in the Gospels. This is quite a bit more sophisticated. It doesn't change anything about the idea of a salvific meaning of the sacrifice of Jesus. But what it changes is how we look at the betrayal. Maybe, in fact, Jesus himself was being liberated from his fleshly garment, being liberated into a spiritual being.
Hold
that
on to that,
well
Ken.
In all of us.
Hold on to that. Now I'm going to ask you if Judas really did kill himself. We'll be back. Ken Hansen, our guest. Ken, history tells us that after Judas sold Christ, basically, for the 30 pieces of silver, he hung himself on a tree branch
Is that true, or do you think that changes?
Well, I've got the actual text of the Gospel of Judas in front of me, and when we follow it on to the end of the document, we get the story about the people coming to arrest Jesus, to arrest him during prayer. They approach Judas. They said to him, "What are you doing here? You are Jesus' disciple." Judas answered them, and he received some money and handed him over to them. Interestingly enough, that's where the text ends.
Ah.
It doesn't say anything more about what happened to Judas. And oftentimes I find that a text is just as compelling or more compelling for what it does not say than for what it does say. However, earlier in this new and yet ancient gospel, we've got a conversation between Jesus and Judas, because, again, we're told that they had a very special, a very close, intimate relationship, and Jesus is sharing specific mysteries with him. And Jesus says to Judas, "You will become the 13th, presumably 13th disciple." We mentioned in the previous segment about the possibility that there, in fact, were not 12, but 13 disciples. "You will be the 13th, and you will be cursed by the other generations." But then Jesus goes on and says, "And you will come to rule over them. In the last days, they will curse your ascent to the holy generation." Now, this is...
I got to tell you, as a layman like I am, you're the expert here. In the last days, they'll curse your ascent. Now, to me, one could say, okay, now we know about this Gospel of Judas. It's making him look better. And people are going to curse that. Some people will.
Well, you bet they will. In fact, I just got an email now from someone who's very upset about
this. Are they blaming you? You're only a messenger here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as surprised as anybody else by the fact that this text has surfaced. I did not expect this. But here we've got these mysterious words, and they are real. The text is genuine. The question is, what do we make of them?
Are we in the midst now of end times, even based on this?
Well, the folks who wrote these texts, and there is a whole library of other ancient texts out there, believe me, seem to be convinced that the end times, quote-unquote, were already beginning in their days. That this was it, that there was a profound disillusionment in the idea that things were getting better. I'm afraid they're not. And we need to look toward a culmination of all of world history. And so they give us many clues and many prophecies, but they believed that even in ancient times, we're talking the first couple of centuries, A.D., we call it Common Era, that the end times were underway. And if you follow this text, that is definitely in line with what the Gnostics were teaching.
Now, how do we know that, or how did the story of Judas hanging himself even occur? I mean, did that come from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or was that made up?
It probably came from this Semitic undertext that I mentioned. It's only theorized. We can't prove that there was such a mysterious text that subsequently got translated to Greek and then disappeared. But I can tell you that there's some very good scholarship going on by, again, Jewish scholars, amazingly, in the land of Israel who think it existed. It was probably part of that early tradition. But then again, what is the writer trying to communicate and to whom? What is his audience? There was not a single Christianity. There were Christianities. It was not an orthodoxy, but a heterodoxy. And what you had going on in the land of Israel was a little bit different than what we find going on in Egypt, for example, where you had these other groups, the Cainites, for example, the Gnostics. They had their own traditions that came down separately and independently, and sometimes they conflict. And one of the most important differences is that they feel that we as human beings have been endowed with a little piece of the divine presence that has emanated from the Big Bang, essentially. And that peace has lodged within every human being. And that what salvation amounts to is not something out there that you go to church and find on Sunday, and you lose again. You got to come back and find it again.
Right.
It's not what I hate to call it, but let's do it. Hell insurance. that's not what salvation really should be understood as. It's discovering that spark of the divine fullness inside of us, and it's that process of self-discovery that is utterly liberating. Even at the point of our death, we are liberated, and that's the ultimate. And so when Jesus dies, according to the Gospel of Judas, he's, in a sense, shedding the outer skin. There's a fascinating part of this text that where Jesus says to Judas, "You will exceed all of them," speaking of the other disciples, "you will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." Now, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Jesus says, "You will sacrifice the man that clothes me." The idea is that even Jesus, as a spiritual being, was clothed with flesh, clothed with a man. And so, Judas, you're going to betray me, you're going to turn me in. That's fine, because I was born to this. The outer man is to be sacrificed. The man who clothes me is to be sacrificed, so that the reality of the divine presence can come forth and spill forth. That's the message that's trying to be conveyed. So the fate of Judas in the end, whether he hangs himself or not, is really irrelevant. The point is this: let's discover who we are, and rather than seeking villains that we can point the finger at and blame, let's look to the divine instead.
Does Jesus tell Judas that he will teach him or show him the mysteries of the universe?
He not only tells him this, but in fact he reveals to him the mysteries of the universe throughout this text. It's incredible. He really lays out the entire Gnostic idea of this Big Bang, as I call it, in the beginning, and the emanation of the divine fullness through a series of, call them divine beings. The Gnostics call them aeons, and that terminology appears in oodles of ancient texts. We already know about the way they thought. But the same exact terminology now appears in this new Gospel of Judas. The aeons, a series of, you can think of them as angels, but let's call them divine emanations from the Almighty. And Jesus is revealing even the names of these aeons to Judas, and only to Judas. And by the way, we know from other Gnostic texts that one of these aeons became Adam.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Well, take us through this portion. I find this to be very fascinating, Ken. Take us through the portion, basically, where he talks about the Big Bang and how things evolve, these mysteries of the universe.
Yeah, it's incredible to see how the ancient cosmology, in some ways, dovetails with modern astrophysics. It's almost spooky to go there in scholarship, because we're supposed to stay away from that kind of those kind of goosebump conclusions. But it really is amazing that the divine, rather than sitting up on a throne with a long beard and deciding what to create, it didn't happen that way. There was an emanation of the divine, not a direct creation, but God emanates into everything. And that's this series of aeons who together form what is called the Pleroma. The Pleroma is the divine fullness. And some of these concepts dovetail with ancient Jewish mysticism, with what we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, with the entire discipline we call Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, that speaks of the same idea, uses different terminology, of course, but the idea of emanation is there. Emanating into everything. And then together, if we can somehow even reconstruct the pieces of the divine fullness, we can form the Pleroma again and bring about what we can call a real salvation at the end of the age.
Does he talk about extraterrestrial life, Ken, that there are beings on other planets in the universe?
He talked about other beings. Now, at that point, again, as scholars, we have to hedge, and we have to say, you have the permission to go there, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You definitely sure have the permission to go there, because we have extraterrestrial beings all over the place, and in this text as well. And,
what,
and some of
all right,
them.
What does he say there? Were you able to break that down for us?
There are so many things up. The various spirits he's talking about, those whose spirits did not dare to stand before God, but only Judas did. He did have the chutzpah, as we call it, to stand before. And then these secrets are revealed. There's a vision of a divine temple. There is an interpretation of that vision. Cosmology. Let me get to the point about cosmology here.
This is the good stuff.
And I've got the text in front of me. There exists a great and boundless realm whose extent no generation of angels has seen, in which there is a great invisible spirit which no eye of an angel has ever seen, no thought of the heart has ever comprehended. And then we get to more of this, which dovetails with the idea of the Gnostics. But here's what it says: a great angel, the enlightened, divine, self-generated, emerged from the cloud. Now that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, sounds like a craft.
Well, I can't say that as a scholar, but I give you permission, George.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Because of him, four other angels came into being from another cloud, and they became attendants for the angelic self-generated. The self-generated said, let come into being, and then we've got the text is mangled at that point. We can't read it. Something about coming into being. And it says, and he created the first luminary to reign over him, something luminous to reign over him. And these are all the secrets now that Jesus is revealing to Judas only. Let an enlightened aeon, there's the term I was talking about.
Right.
Let an enlightened aeon come into being. And he came into being. He created the second luminary to reign over him, together with myriads of angels without number to offer sacrifice. That is how he created the rest of the enlightened aeons. He made them to reign over them, and he created them, myriads without number, to assist them.
Does he talk about the fallen angels at all, about Lucifer, Satan?
Not in this particular text. He names specific angels. He gives them names. One is called Adamas, and it's hauntingly similar to the Hebrew word Adama, which means earth. So, again, the text is so sparse in what it tells us and also what it doesn't tell us. Could this be some reference to the angels who fell? Now, the Gnostics did have a very well-developed, let's call it folklore, about angelic beings who came to the earth, who cohabited with earth women and spawned a race of half-breeds,
right,
of giants. And we're told from other Gnostic sources, not from this one, but from other books, I call it the Lost Bible, and I've written an entire book on the secrets of the Lost Bible. We have other books that mention this in detail and say that this race of beings from the fallen angels actually was responsible for the sending of the flood, because they began to devour human flesh. And if God had not sent the flood of Noah to destroy them, they would have eaten us all.
There were cannibals?
Apparently, who grew to monstrous size, 300 cubits tall. Again, I'm referencing other texts now. Here we've got this mysterious Adamas, which means the earth. So is this one that fell to the earth? I can't weigh in on that. But it says he was in the first luminous cloud. that luminous cloud again. Isn't that interesting, George?
Yeah.
that no angel has ever seen. As a scholar, of course, I just report. You decide.
I will decide. That's exactly
that no angel has ever seen among all those called God. And then it goes on and talks about 72 luminaries who appear in the incorruptible generation. And then,
wouldn't it be incredible, Ken, if Jesus in this gospel is talking to Judas, telling him about extraterrestrial life, verifying that craft has come down to the planet, talking to him about a bigger picture? I mean, it's absolutely startling.
It is. And I can't say as a scholar that Jesus said these words verbatim. Again, we have so many different traditions and they conflict. But what I can say is that this text is extremely old. We're talking earlier than 180 of the Common Era, that is A.D., and does reflect ancient traditions that were out there. Whether Jesus, we want to believe that Jesus said this verbatim, is really not as important as the fact that these people had these traditions. The traditions existed.
Does it get into Revelation as John did?
In the sense that it does talk about the end, yes. It's not as specific as John. Again, the text has suffered a lot of decay.
And you're talking about physical decay. Okay.
Yes, physical decay. Right. But it certainly talks about the end, the last days that I already mentioned. Much of it's just a word here, a word there, but you can tell it is definitely apocalyptic.
This is just an absolute startling revelation all
it's
by itself.
It's startling.
For it to come out around Easter, Passover, also, I mean, yeah. They've got to have timed it this way, don't you think?
Could be. Yeah, it certainly could be. But I believe in miracles, too, so...
Did they talk about, in the Gospel of Judas, the crucifixion and the resurrection?
It's basically understood. In other words, that part of the story is already known to the audience. So they're not going over that specifically. They're filling in the pieces that you wouldn't have gotten elsewhere. And that seems to be the purpose.
Does it kind of attest to the fact that Jesus was indeed a different person, maybe the Son of Man, Son of God, but that he had very strong supernatural powers?
It mentions specifically the expression Son of God and that the disciples were acknowledging him this way. It also says that he often did not appear to his disciples as himself. Then it says, but he was found among them as a child.
He had this ability to shapeshift.
Apparently. And that's what the text is suggesting to us. Or although it might be purely metaphysical in the sense of the spirit of the child coming through him. You have to take these on different levels. And that's the trouble with it, but also the beauty of it, that you cannot say it means specifically one thing only.
How important do you think this gospel is now compared to the other four?
Huge. It's huge. Because of its antiquity, because of its recentness, because it's attested to as early as Bishop Athanasius in 180 A.D. This will send shockwaves, no question.
Stay with us. Dr. Ken Hansen, when we come back, let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls and also... You have now perked my interest. I want to talk with you about the fallen angels and these giants that apparently were cannibals. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Dr. Ken Hansen, our guest, as we talk about the incredible story, of course, the Gospel of Judas. Ken, let's take some time this hour, if we can, to talk about what really happened as this planet was formed. Who came down here? What did they do? And the fact that they were cannibals. I mean, this is an incredible story all by itself. What can you share for us here?
Yeah, we have so many texts that were literally banned from the Bible, just kicked out, excluded, not accepted by religious authorities, religious and political leaders, just didn't want these texts accepted, and yet they're there. They were copied from time to time through the ages, and we keep getting more of them that, in fact, illumine various passages of the biblical text that are so sparse. Now we've got additional information about Earth's earliest ages. One of my specialty areas is, of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is another amazing Indiana Jones saga. These things surfaced out of the blue, out of nowhere, in 1947, and contain copies of at least fragments of every book in the Hebrew Bible, except one, that's the book of Esther. But additionally, there are thousands and thousands of fragments of non-biblical texts. Some of them we've known existed, some of them we never knew existed. And to piece this library together, in fact, illumines Earth's earliest ages in ways that we never imagined before. One of my research projects, scholarly research projects, is to ask, what did the book of Genesis look like to the earliest generations of the Israelites? Did it look exactly the way it does now, or were there things that didn't quite make the cut as the ages passed? And with the material from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we can now fit in, as it were, between the verses, whole passages that you won't find in your Bibles. For example, having to do with a race of apparently giants who were spawned by angelic beings. If we look at the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis, chapter 5, verse 28, it talks about the patriarch Lamech. It says he lived 182 years and became the father of a son and called his name Noah. We've all heard of Noah. Mm-hmm. But now, piecing together, if we take these scraps from the Dead Sea Scrolls and fit them into Genesis, there's an entire passage that we could add directly after that verse. And it goes like this. However, when Lamech, that's this patriarch, was convinced in his heart that his wife's pregnancy came about through the heavenly watchers, the holy ones, and the giants. What on earth? And we piece some more fragments together, and we're told that while the sons of men multiplied, fair and lovely daughters were born to them, and the watchers. These extraneous texts refer to them as the watchers. That's interesting language, isn't it? Those sons of heaven were attracted to them and lusted for them, said to one another, come, let us seek out the daughters of men, rear sons for ourselves. The text goes on and says that they reared this generation, this breed of giants, of half-breeds, and they taught them witchcraft, magic spells, how to cut roots and herbs for their conjurations. They gave birth to the giants, who grew up to be 3,000 cubits tall. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites, and so they consumed the produce and the labor of men. And therefore, the giants, the Nephilim, that's the Hebrew word that we do find in the Hebrew Bible, in the book of Genesis, but it just gives us this one little verse and then goes on. This whole passage is now elaborated. The Nephilim, literally that word in Hebrew means the fallen ones. That's what that word means. The root nafal means to fall. So they conspired to kill the men and eat them, performed sinful acts. And everyone started disclosing these secrets to their wives, as a result of which many people were struck dead. And at that time, Michael, Sariel, Raphael, and Gabriel looked down from the holy places of the heavens, and they decide that they must do something, to make a long story short, to annihilate the offspring of the watchers from among humankind. And God commissions them to annihilate this race of half-breeds before they destroy the rest of humanity. Go bind them in chains in the earth's great valleys for 70 generations until their judgment day.
What an incredible story. How many of them do you think there were, Ken?
We're told that there were several hundred. The text might even tell us specifically. I'd have to go search for that. But
now, why are you doing that, too? When you said 3,000 cubic feet tall.
3,000 cubits.
Now, how tall is this?
Well, a biblical cubit is about from the elbow to the end of the hand.
Yeah, it's about 18 inches.
Yeah,
4,000 feet tall?
That's what it says, 3,000 cubits tall. That's unbelievable.
4,000-foot person?
That's what it says.
Where are the bones for something like that, huh?
You got to ask.
Yeah.
You know, of course, maybe they found some bones in that part of the world and began to wonder, where do these things come from?
4,000 feet, that's a big person.
Yeah, that is definitely. That is definitely. Of course, many of these numbers in the biblical text are symbolic. And I wouldn't, as a scholar, say, now we have to take all of this literally. These things are mysteries. They're communicated as mysteries. And you take it for what they are. It doesn't necessarily say these are aliens either or spacecraft. You know, I'm giving you permission to go there.
Well, you know what? Are you familiar with the Nag Hammadi?
Absolutely.
Sure. John Lash, a former guest of ours, he was talking about what he described as the Archons, A-R-C-H-O-N-S, pretty close to what you were saying. And he believes that the people were abducted by what he calls predatory aliens called the Archons.
The Archons, right.
Archons. So it's an interesting analogy there.
Yeah, the predatory. Predatory.
Yes.
That is a very ancient tradition, and the bottom line is that in the ancient world, that this was the actual original sin, quote unquote, that brought about the flood. And this is astounding to most moderns who just read the traditional text and say, well, original sin, that was when Adam and Eve ate the apple and sin exploded on the earth and the flood was sent. That is not what rank and file ancients believed. The original sin was this coming down, this descent, this cohabiting.
Did Paul warn of the teachings of the Gnostics as being false teachings? Were they branded as heretics in that day?
Oh my, it was explosive. It was bitter, back and forth. And Paul especially damned the Gnostics as abominable heretics. And that is why, in fact, so many of these texts didn't make the cut. So many of them were banned from the Bible because they found something in them that sounded Gnostic. Some of the texts are clearly in the Gnostic category, but Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, these are Jewish texts. They're written in Hebrew. And yet, there are certain ideas that link these all together. And many of the keepers of the canon, as I call them, the religious leaders who decided which books make the cut, simply decided, it sounds a little bit on the Gnostic side. And being captivated by Paul's very powerful personality, they won the day.
The era, I think, a couple thousand years ago, I'm glad I'm not around in those days. It sounded like a pretty violent period.
Violent and volatile, but extremely fascinating. It was diversity, and that's the word for ancient Christianity. There wasn't an orthodoxy. There was a heterodoxy. And I think one of the big problems that we have is trying to say that there's only one meaning out there that's acceptable, and we have to decide what that meaning is, and everybody has to espouse to that meaning, or you're doomed as a heretic. That's really sad. Because clearly the earliest Christians didn't have one meaning.
Did the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls alter or convince us anything that we didn't already know?
It was another earth-shattering event that fundamentally changed the entire landscape of biblical scholarship, of the development of ancient Judaism, of the very beginnings of Christianity. It's a whole world that we never knew existed before. Earth-shattering. And out of the blue, in the middle of the 20th century, found by a Bedouin shepherd boy in some caves opposite the Dead Sea, lowest spot on the earth, in the middle of the Judean desert, stumbles upon these crumbling parchments. He doesn't even know what they are. And as with the Gospel of Judas, they're picked up by an antiquities dealer, they're passed from hand to hand, put on the market, sold, and finally, after a lengthy period of time, years in many cases, decades in other cases, deciphered, many of them had to be pieced together as an enormous jigsaw puzzle, and we find that in fact they contain hundreds of texts. Some of them Gnostic, quote-unquote Gnostic. We call them Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. These are the books that didn't make it. As well as entire manuals, rule books, apocalyptic war books about the end of the age. One major war scroll that we didn't even know existed suddenly surfaces in the middle of the 20th century.
Isn't it true that they have not deciphered all of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
They're all out there now and in the open. The fragments that I'm talking about, the enormous jigsaw puzzle, thousands, tens of thousands of these fragments were sequestered for some 40 years in the basement of the East Jerusalem Rockefeller Museum, and no one was allowed access to them or even photocopies of these very important texts, these fragments, except just a select handful of scholars. No one could see them, and that, of course, gave rise to a lot of theories and conspiracy theories as well.
Oh,
What are you hiding in there? What kind of incendiary material do you have in the basement of the Rockefeller Museum? It took a long time, and in fact, lawsuits were filed in the end. Eventually, the logjam broke, and this material began trickling out steadily and then in a flood. And in fact, it's out there. It's changed everything we know about the biblical world, and some pretty astounding material.
What are the odds, Ken, that there might be more scrolls out there somewhere?
As I mentioned at the start of the broadcast, I get asked this question, and I kind of chuckle to myself and say, yes, I suppose it's possible that there is more material out there. And yet deep inside, I'm thinking, nah, we found everything that could be found has been found. The odds against it are so astronomical. And then what happens? Within a week, we come across the Gospel of Judas. So at this point, I have to say, yeah, it's entirely possible that we'll find even more.
Well, you know, as we've just discussed with the Gospel of Judas, it was found years ago, but we just find out about it now. I wonder what else is out there, Ken. I mean, I wonder if the Ark of the Covenant has been found, and we just haven't been told about it yet.
Well, I know of one. Let's call him renegade archaeologist who believes that the famous Dead Sea Copper Scroll contains clues to the whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant. He's been looking for it for a long time. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls is completely different from all of the others. Most all of them were composed on parchment material called vellum. It's the skin of kosher animals that's sewed together very much like modern Torah scrolls are sewn together and inscribed today for synagogues. Same materials used, same techniques, but one Dead Sea Scroll was completely different, found in the 1950s by the archaeologists, again in one of those caves. The contents were pounded into sheets of highly refined copper, the copper scroll. One piece of copper then was riveted into the next, rolled up into a scroll and abandoned in that cave for two millennia. And when it was finally sawed into pieces, it was the only way they could open it because the copper had oxidized, they found inscribed on it an inventory, believe it or not, of buried treasure. More than 200 tons of gold and silver, as well as consecrated items, artifacts, apparently from the ancient temple of Jerusalem. And could we not be looking here at possible whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant? As I mentioned, one, let's call him renegade archaeologist, believes that is in fact a possibility. You never know, though the biblical world can so surprise us, and it's always changing.
This cubic thing is driving me nuts, Ken. I want you to basically tell us this again. I'm beginning to wonder if they were talking about the spacecraft that they showed up in.
Who knows? It says that the women became pregnant by the watchers. Now, I'm reading my own retranslation, actually, of these ancient texts from the original language. Then I've smoothed out into a more of a modern, lively, semi-paraphrase. The women became pregnant by these watchers. They gave birth to the giants who grew up to be, up to 3,000 cubits tall. They were born according to the laws of nature and grew up at a constant rate. Moreover, they were consumed. They consumed the produce of the labor of men. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites. Therefore, the giants, the Nephilim, conspired to kill the men and eat them. Now, according to the story, Noah's father is himself concerned that Noah might be one of these offspring, born according to the laws of nature and yet grew up at a constant rate to become a giant. And so we're told in one of these books that got banned from the Bible that Noah's father, Lamech, goes upward, an upward ascent into the heavens to find his father, Methuselah, to ask him about Noah. Is this a normal child or is this the offspring of one of the watchers? This whole incredible story is related to it.
I've got to believe that could have been a typo passed down, maybe 30 cubics. That would make him 45 feet tall. Now,
yeah,
that's a giant.
Although they didn't, we're talking about ancient Hebrew letters here, so you're not looking at Arabic numerals. I would have to go and consult the original text, but I'm almost sure it says Shloshim Elif. I'm sorry, Shalosh Elif, that is 3,000 written out.
But an earth woman would give birth to a little kid who could become then 3,000 feet tall?
That's the story. Would be born according to the laws of nature. And there are other mysterious Dead Sea Scroll fragments. Most people don't know these exist, but one of them is about Noah, specifically about Noah, trying to prove that he's not one of the giants, one of these strange offspring.
Man, that is weird. We'll be back with you, Ken, in just a moment. On Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie. Ken, tell me a little bit about the Essenes, because I want to get into some of the treasures that they apparently had and where it might be. But what can you tell us about them, this sect?
Ancient group of pious Judeans described in vivid detail by the ancient Jewish historian Josephus Flavius in the first century of the Common Era, that is A.D., all we knew about was what Josephus told us about them, a pietistic group who cultivated a sense of vision that gave them foreknowledge of future events revealed by God, who apparently had incredible powers of healing, who also, by the way, according to Josephus, lived regularly to be over 100 years. They were centenarians, according to Josephus, by virtue of their diet and the regular course of life they exercised also. There were little pockets of these groups scattered all around ancient Judea in the days of Jesus and John the Baptist and King Herod and the Romans, and there seems to have been a headquarters of the group that literally separated from the rest of society, went out to the corner, the northwest corner of the Dead Sea, and established an alternate society, literally, a community of their own on the edge of eternity, as it were, awaiting the apocalypse, the messianic age. But we didn't have any of their writings, only what the ancient historian Josephus told us about them until the Dead Sea Scrolls surfaced. And scholars immediately were arrested by these documents, and they looked at the contents of these scrolls found in the middle of the 20th century and compared them with what Josephus had already written two millennia ago, and they said, by golly, we've got the library now of the ancient Essenes.
Did they amount to vast treasures, and if so, where might they be?
All we know is we've got this mysterious copper scroll. more than 200 tons of gold and silver, consecrated items from the sacred temple in Jerusalem. Now, what is this? Scholars were puzzled by that immediately. And by the way, when they first deciphered the copper scroll back in the 1950s, they dropped everything, ran out into the desert with metal detectors, I'm serious, looking for the treasure, because the scroll actually gives clues as to where this stuff is buried, out in the desert and in the city of Jerusalem. They went on a major excavation trying to find the treasure, found nothing. And the questions persist. Was this whole thing just a hoax? Did somebody inscribe this scroll with an expensive material like this for nothing, just as some sort of game? Or maybe somebody found the treasure already at some point in time. But that would really be kind of puzzling and curious because, you know, when treasures did surface in the ancient world, people like to write about them. We have a lot of ancient historians who wrote about incredible treasures that were found. For example, Cleopatra's treasure was seized on the Mediterranean Sea when her boyfriend, Mark Antony, was defeated by the forces of Octavian. And they took that treasure back to Rome. Everybody knew about it. They wrote about it. It caused a spike of inflation in the city of Rome. You didn't find treasures of that magnitude, and nobody knew about it. So the puzzle still persists. If this thing were real and if nobody has found it, then in fact maybe it is still out there.
I'll always remember the Indiana Jones movies where they had that Knights Templar type person guarding the Holy Grail, and he was surrounded with treasures. And I'm just wondering if that might have been based on the Essenes and the rumors of their treasures.
Well, we didn't know anything again about the Essene treasures until the copper scroll was found. And we can't even be sure that this was the treasure of the Essenes. It was found in one of these caves near all of the other Dead Sea Scrolls, but nothing on the copper scroll says this is the work of the Essenes, this is the work of the Dead Sea sect. Some have theorized that this, in fact, may have been put there by somebody else entirely. Just happens to have been deposited in a cave nearby the Essene headquarters, maybe by folks from Jerusalem who were fleeing from the Romans in those days and decided to hide the temple treasure out in the middle of nowhere. We don't know. It's that kind of a mystery. Personally, I like to think that this was, in fact, the treasure of the Essenes. These people, for a couple of centuries, lived out there in their own community, their own society. They pooled all of their resources. Everything they had, they shared together. They lived along the trade routes, and they bought and sold. They cultivated crops. Over that period of time, they lived very, very frugally, and they amassed treasure. And I like to think, in fact, that this thing is genuine. The very last item in the copper scroll talks about a copy of this document. And I'm quoting it now, with an inventory and their measurements and a listing of each thing and other things, unquote. A copy of this document is the last item in the copper scroll. So my question is, perhaps, do you suppose that the copper scroll that was found was a decoy and that the locations of the treasure are wrong in the one that we found, but that the scroll with the correct locations has never been found, and that's the last item that's listed?
Well, this Friday marks the beginning of a holy period for Christians all around this planet, that being Good Friday through Easter. The episodes that led up through Good Friday and then the resurrection 3 days later, do you believe that those episodes truly occurred, Ken Hansen?
I can tell you that we are in the midst of incredible Jesus research on a scholarly level as has never been before. We know more about the historical Jesus today than we have ever known in two millennia of Christian history. And the beautiful thing is, it's not just Christians involved. As I've already alluded to, there are many Jewish scholars involved in this. And I personally think that we can nail a lot of the events in the life of Jesus as historical. And certainly, Jesus was in Jerusalem right about this time. I was in Jerusalem not long ago leading a group, and I do that from time to time. I'll be leading another one in December. Folks can find out about it on my website. But we've got the location for the crucifixion of Jesus. Whether you're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever you are, we know historically where this event happened, and it's dead on. It's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a very dank, dark, musty, early medieval church. A lot of American tourists don't like even getting near the place and don't like thinking, to be honest, that this is the place where Jesus was crucified. But everything points to that. Everything points to this as being the historical location of the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's staggering.
Is that on Calvary?
It is what we call Mount Calvary. Now, we know exactly where that was in ancient Jerusalem, and there's precious little left of Mount Calvary today because the mother of the Emperor Constantine, her name was Helena, Queen Helena, was a Christian. Constantine was, of course, the Roman emperor who converted to Christianity and changed the whole course of history. His mother went around the Holy Land looking for holy sites, where this event happened, that event happened. Where was Jesus born? We'll plant a church there. Where was the Annunciation to Mary? We'll plant a church there. Most of these locations are bogus. And Constantine's mother, Helena, just asked the locals, you know, where do you think this happened? And whatever they said, that's where she planted a church. Well, lo and behold, the one for Calvary, she got right. She had to have gotten right. As I say, there's not much left of Mount Calvary today because she built a church right on that spot. But there is a small outcropping of bedrock that was in fact there in the first century of the Common Era, and precisely underneath that church are tombs dating from the first century AD, exactly as they should have been according to the gospel accounts. It's uncanny. It's staggering. And what I can tell you this, that in spite of all of the divisiveness in ancient Christianity, and they were coming to blows, literally, between Paul's group and the Gnostics. There were other groups we didn't mention. The Ebionites, for example, who were pious Christians, but who didn't believe in the incarnation or that Jesus was divine. They believed he was the Messiah, but not divine. They didn't agree on anything. They were fighting and shouting with each other, but the one thing that they all agreed on, whether you are a Christian or not, whether you believe it or not, they all agreed on the empty tomb. The fact they believed.
It must have been strange, Ken, to be in an era where you could feel that if that was the spot where Jesus was crucified, you could feel that, I bet. You could absolutely feel that.
You get goosebumps. I mean, again, whether you happen to be a Christian or not, there is something very, very historical and extraordinary here at that spot. The surroundings for a Westerner like myself are pretty depressing. This is early Romanesque architecture, dank, dusty, but you know you're in an authentic place.
Is there much talk about the devil on any of these texts, scrolls, anything that has been found?
That's one extraordinary aspect of these books that probably helped get many of them banned, as a matter of fact, especially in the Jewish world. These books we call Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. I wrote an entire book called Secrets from the Lost Bible dealing with these banned books, and another one called the Essene Book of Everyday Virtues. If our audience is wondering about these texts I quoted from the book of Genesis, where we can fill them in, you want to head to the website and get hold of these books. But back to our question on the devil, these books do mention powers of evil. They mention, as it were, the force and the dark side. And we even have Darth Vader. We've got a Darth Vader. You bet. We've got a Darth Vader type figure in the Dead Sea Scrolls called the Wicked Priest. That's the only name he's ever given. But he seems to be consumed or driven by a satanic agency. And he is in mortal combat with the apparent leader of the ancient Essenes called the Teacher of Righteousness. Now, that's an interesting title. the teacher of righteousness, who lived at some time in the first century B.C. And the two of these characters engage in mortal combat on, of all days, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And the wicked priest slays the teacher of righteousness. I mean, this is right out of George Lucas. Unbelievable. But this is the kind of thing that certain religious leaders, especially in the Jewish world, looked at askance. Because if you start talking about evil power, some evil agency, a satanic figure, and Satan appears by name prominently in many of these banned books, that somehow impinges on the unity of God, on monotheism itself, because the sages started asking, how many gods do we have here, one or two? That was enough to get them banned.
Do you believe the Shroud of Turin is authentic, Ken?
I've just been researching that topic and seem to be of a mind, this is just my opinion, that we might be looking at the work of Leonardo da Vinci. Here's the thing about the Shroud, is that we've got carbon dating, and I know that that's called into question as well.
Right.
Maybe the carbon dating is off, but it would have to be pretty majorly off. That we don't have anything to suggest that the fact that a fire occurred in Turin, Italy, really could have changed the carbon dating to that extent. Anything can happen in this world, as we know, but the same techniques of carbon dating have been used on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and without question, these are over 2,000 years old. So for my money, if it works on the Dead Sea Scrolls, it ought to work on the Shroud of Turin. I like the Da Vinci idea.
It's very, very possible, though, that even if Da Vinci, let's say, sketched this, painted this,
mm-hmm.
With his incredible mind of reverse imagery, maybe it was based on something he believed was real.
There are traditions of an image of Jesus that go way back. There are also traditions that Helena, Constantine's mother, found the true cross on the site where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built. At that point, as scholars, we just have to stand back and say, well, here's a tradition here, here's a tradition there. Do with this what you will. There's a lot of mysteries out there, that's for sure.
Do they know where the tomb is, perhaps, where Christ was buried for those several days?
We can say where Mount Calvary was. And again, I was just there, led a little group. I never take more than 10 individuals, by the way, because we do intimate tours. But we can get up close and personal with the rock, with Calvary. We know that in the basement, downstairs, we can walk among first century tombs. We cannot say with certainty which one was the tomb of Jesus of Nazareth. But here's the deal. Again, whether you're a Christian or not, the early Christians believed it. They were absolutely convinced that that tomb was empty. You don't go out and turn the world upside down on the basis of something that you know was a lie. So you can debate theology up and down, backwards and forwards. They did then, and people still do today. But what it was all grounded in was an overwhelming belief that this tomb was empty.
Do you believe that at least one of those tombs might be where Jesus' body was placed?
It's entirely possible, yes. Yes, I do. But the thing is, we know that this is an entire cemetery underground. So much of Jerusalem is subterranean. So there's more of it that potentially is still underground. So only a few tombs are actually accessible to us.
Now, you're right. So much of Jerusalem is underground. Why is that? Why a long time ago did they do this?
Because the city has been destroyed umpteen times, perhaps the most devastating destruction by the Roman Empire in the year 70 of the Common Era, when a massive revolt broke out among the Jewish population. These were the ancient Bravehearts in Mel Gibson variety, seriously, shouting freedom, and we want our land. The Romans were not necessarily nice folks. It was a massive revolt, and the Romans put it down with such fury. Josephus describes this in detail. I quote Josephus in my own books, and fit this in with what we read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are almost prophesying the course of this disastrous revolt. The ideas of the scrolls had certainly gotten out into the general population, and they were expecting in those days the apocalypse, the end of everything, and that they would be miraculously rescued. Unfortunately, they were not. And the Romans destroyed the city, they destroyed the temple, burned it to the ground. Josephus tells us that some 1,100,000 Jews died in that horrific siege. They were literally eating their own children, some of them. It was that bad.
Oh, God.
The city was covered in rubble. When you go up to the wall, the western wall, the last vestige of the ancient temple of Jerusalem today, you're standing on about 40 feet of Roman rubble. That's why so much is underground.
Would you like to have lived in that time period?
Yes and no. Not to be part of that revolt.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie, Dr. Ken Hansen. Ken, what's on your plate in the not-too-distant future? We haven't talked to you since March, so what's new for you?
Always doing new things. This new book of mine is just hitting the shelves, called The Essene Book of Everyday Virtues. So I'm out promoting it. I've gone back to the Dead Sea Scrolls and retranslated them in what I call a lively paraphrase, kind of the living Dead Sea Scrolls, taken what I think are some of the best and most really uplifting passages, and put together a series of 10 disciplines from the Dead Sea Scrolls which could enhance modern life. So I'm going out and sharing about what the Essenes would tell us in the 21st century if we could bring them here today. I even dramatize the Dead Sea Scrolls. I do a theatrical performance and basically become an Indiana Jones-type character who discovers the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I do this on stage, as well as, of course, an Israel tour that I'm putting together for December. And you can find out about all this and more at treasuresintime.org. That's my website, treasuresintime.org.
When we were talking about the Ark of the Covenant, you were talking about an old-time archaeologist who'd be looking for the Ark. Is that Vendel Jones or is that someone else?
It does indeed happen to be Vendel Jones. But he's only one, and there are other options for where the Ark might be located, assuming that it survived, of course. And we just don't have any hard evidence that it even survived. But if it did, another colleague of mine believes that it might be located somewhere in the subterranean area underneath the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Again, so much of Jerusalem is underground. It's subterranean. And some exploration has been done in that vicinity. However, because of the politics involved, it is extremely volatile. And it is just impossible to be excavating underneath the Dome of the Rock, which is, of course, the third holiest site in Islam. But interestingly, there are other books of the Lost Bible, which I also write about, that do make mention of the Ark of the Covenant. One of them says that at the time that the temple was destroyed, an angel kind of came down and supervised what would happen to the furniture in the temple, even as it was being destroyed. And this book tells us that a fissure opened up and the earth literally swallowed the ornamental furniture of the temple, including the Ark of the Covenant. So that would give us a suggestion that maybe it is, in fact, underneath the Temple Mount. And another of these lost books, called the Book of Second Maccabees, tells us that at the time the temple was destroyed, the prophet Jeremiah personally oversaw carting the Ark of the Covenant away from Jerusalem and took it out into a cave, wouldn't you know, that would probably be in the area of Jordan today, Transjordan, and that cave was sealed up and that no one knows its whereabouts or will know its whereabouts until the end of days when it will be revealed.
There's so many secrets on this planet, Ken, so many.
Absolutely. That's what makes it fun.
That is true. Let's go to the phones. First time caller, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Welcome to the show, and where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Anaheim, California.
Okay, please go ahead, sir.
How are you, George, and how are you, Dr.
Good.
Hansen?
Good, we are fine.
I'm glad you have a good guest on. I had so many questions. I just recently went to the Holy Land, and basically by myself, not with my church, to try to ask the local people questions. And I was just shocked, and maybe Dr. Hansen, you can help me with this. Why, when I went to see the, have you been to the tomb of Abraham and Joseph and
yes.
all these? I was shocked that the Muslims have their tombs. It was a shock to me. I thought it would be Jewish or Christian, but they were all mosques. And then we wanted to ask for John the Baptist to see if they have his body or his head or whatever, and they told us you have to find it in Damascus. It's in a mosque. But could you please elaborate on that? It's very shocking for me as a Christian. We were never taught this here.
Well, the land of Israel is an amazing place. I've lived there for several years. I worked in Lebanon, in fact, in a war zone. So one is constantly aware that one is living in this incredibly rich ancient land, and history and spirituality is all around you, and yet the reality of the modern political world is always there at every hand. Things are tense. It's a tough neighborhood, and we're dealing with ground that is sacred to the three dominant religious traditions of the Western world: Judaism, Christianity, and yes, Islam.
Yeah, that's what's a shock to me, is that Islam would revere Abraham and John the Baptist and Zechariah. I went to Zechariah's tomb, Joseph's tomb, and they were all mosques. They're not even churches. I don't understand why they're mosques.
Well, now, Muslims do revere and accept the biblical patriarchs, the biblical heroes. They accept the biblical accounts in general, though they think that there has been some tampering that's been done, and that the true revelation, of course, is the Quran. But Abraham is known as Ibrahim in Arabic, and yes, he's revered. Jesus is revered and respected by Muslims,
right.
By Islam. So, of course, these would be holy sites for Muslims as well. You've got them holy to Jews, you've got them holy to Muslims. Take the Temple Mount, for example, which is an amazing but unbelievable situation, where you've got the holiest site in the entire Jewish world, and sitting right on top of it is a mosque. Well, I think
the Crusades were fought over that, weren't they, over that mosque? I mean, wasn't it a church before that? Isn't that basically what
the Crusaders were there after the Muslims built the mosque and turned it into a church, and then the Crusaders were expelled. It's actually not a mosque. It's a shrine. It's the Dome of the Rock. The mosque is next to it, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But it's interesting that Orthodox Jews are not allowed even to go up there on top of the Temple Mount, because we're not exactly sure where the temple stood. For my money, I'm convinced that the Dome of the Rock is directly over the spot of the ancient temple itself. I'm absolutely convinced.
It's a beautiful building, by the way.
Beautiful building. It is, and it sits over bedrock. And someone took a camera up in more serene days, up to the very top of that dome, and photographed the rock underneath, and started doing measurements on a series of little indentations in the rock. It is called the Dome of the Rock because it sits over this outcropping of bedrock. Now, this is the spot where the prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was, according to the story, lifted up into the heavens, and his heart was washed by Allah and then inserted back into his body, and he went back to Mecca supernaturally all in one night. And so that is why that rock is revered by Muslims. But when you start measuring these little telltale indentations that I had always noticed in that rock but never paid any attention, the measurements just happened to coincide exactly with what the Talmud, that is rabbinic sources, say were the measurements of the Holy of Holies, and sure enough, a smaller series of grooves corresponds exactly with the Ark of the Covenant. I cannot tell you where the Ark of the Covenant is today, but I can tell you where I'm convinced it was, and the actual grooves in that rock. That's the site of the temple, I'm sure.
That's amazing, because you see, like my church pastor, when I explained to him what I told him, He told me the Muslims don't believe in the same God. And I told him, how can that be when they have Abraham, the Abraham Mosque, the Joseph Mosque, the Zechariah, and John the Baptist's body? It doesn't make sense that they wouldn't believe in the same God as us. Why would they revere these holy men?
Well,
my pastor couldn't explain it to me.
I think they are, Ken. Don't they believe in the same God?
Yeah.
They do, but there's a lot of Christian churches are saying that the Muslims don't, and I don't know why they say that, because I've been there to the Middle East, and the Jews, the Muslims, and Christians, they do believe in the same God.
Well, let me ask you, Ken, why, and thanks for your call, I appreciate it, why are we in such religious chaos, fighting between Muslims, Christians, when their belief system is pretty darn similar?
Yeah, it certainly is. And one of the things that I really pride myself on as a scholar is building bridges and opening up avenues and channels of communication between various religious groups. At the University of Central Florida, I teach students who are Jews, who are Christians, who are Muslims. This is a truly interfaith environment. And what a wonderful chance in the 21st century to look now at ancient texts that have surfaced for the first time in two millennia and sit down from various faith backgrounds and just look at these texts together and say, now what do these mean to all of us? Not beat each other over the head saying, my religion is better than yours. I'm always very careful in not dumping on someone else's religion. But yeah, we have commonalities, and they're staggering. From my perspective, yes, definitely Jews, Christians, Muslims worship the same God. The word Allah or Allah is almost identical to the Hebrew word for God, El, or Elohim. That's no accident. Hebrew and Arabic are Semitic languages. At least 40 to 50% of the vocabulary between Hebrew and Arabic is cognate, including many, many spiritual terms, such as Rahum in Arabic means merciful. And in Hebrew we say Rahman, the merciful one. Salam, of course, in Arabic, and Shalom in Hebrew, and Jews and Arabs refer to each other, by the way, as cousin in the Middle East today, and yet in spite of all of that, we have such a charged atmosphere that's political, that is involved with a resurgence of religious fundamentalism on every level, and I think that is the phenomenon we can point our finger at, is this resurgence of rabid religious fundamentalism that has, as it were, jolted these major religions off their center and toward more of a fringe, where we can't talk to each other anymore. We are talking at each other and against each other.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with Dr. Ken Hansen on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. At the beginning of the program, you were discussing this new gospel of, Judas. Not a new gospel, but the gospel of Judas. And from my reading of the New Testament, Yeshua, which I really prefer to call him, was his Hebrew name rather than Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I understand that means Yahweh is salvation.
In salvation, but, yes.
Yes, uh-huh. And it's the same as the name, the English name Joshua.
Very similar.
People in his promised
Yeshua
land.
Or Yehoshua, Joshua.
Right. But when Yeshua was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prayed to his Father, oh, that this cup would pass from me, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually more the Father's plan rather than his plan or Judas's plan. And Jesus also said that he would be betrayed by his friend. And I understand that his disciples, when they were eating the Last Supper with Jesus, asked Yeshua, who is it that will betray you? And he said, the one who dips his bread in the sop. So he already knew what was going to happen and who it would be that would betray him. But he also understood that it was part of the Father's plan.
Yes, and it's that part of the Father's plan that is significant here. And we do find in various textual traditions, from the Gnostic texts to the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha to the Dead Sea Scrolls and the New Testament, we find a dominant theme of what we would call today predestination. In other words, everything is planned. There is nothing that happens by accident. Even if we have a sense of perhaps foreboding about the future. Martin Luther King knew it, didn't he? Even the night that he was assassinated. And yet there's not anything lost in God's economy. That's a saying that I like. Nothing is lost in God's economy. Everything is, in a sense, predestined. It is foreordered. It is foreordained. That's what these texts say. Now, you don't have to bite into that. I'm just telling you what even the New Testament teaches as a scholar. I'm not endorsing it, but that's where it comes down. So on that level, I can quote to you another scholar who has recently weighed in on the Gospel of Judas and said this. So what does that make Judas? Is he the betrayer or the facilitator of salvation? The guy who makes the crucifixion possible. Think of it that way. Is he the facilitator of salvation? And let me tell you, before even the Gospel of Judas was found, many Christians have asked themselves, wait a second, if it was somehow God's goodwill that Jesus die as a sacrifice, as it were, well, then isn't Judas an integral part of God's plan?
You know, Ken, the older I get, I begin to become more and more fascinated with this topic, where years ago as a kid and then as a younger adult, wasn't that interested. But now, as we talk about end times and everything else, it's almost as if I'm obsessed with it. Why is that? Is that a natural progression for us?
I think it can be, and especially with what we're seeing going on internationally and in the political environment, we're seeing a radicalization that is downright spooky and really apocalyptic on a lot of levels. And what I often do is to see patterns in history. The last time that there was such a radicalization was in the first century of the Common Era, the first century A.D., when the Jewish population of the land of Israel really became radicalized. You can call it ancient fundamentalism, and they became convinced that the end of everything was at hand, and in spite of the fact that they were staring down the most powerful empire in the world, Rome, that they would be supernaturally delivered, so let us start this mad revolt against the Roman Empire, even if it kills us all, and ultimately it just about did. It's that kind of fringe radicalization that we're seeing again, and in many different groups, and Islam is an example. I'm a great believer in building bridges and in interfaith relations. So when we talk about Islam, let's make sure we're not talking about traditional, healthy Islam, which is right on the wavelength of most all of us, even if we don't realize it, but it's a certain radical fringe. It makes you look at the world and say, maybe indeed the end is near.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good, thank you.
George, Dr. Ken, I would love to ask a question about the origination of the scrolls and what they actually mean. And by that, I just want to delve back into the caveman times, about when we first saw caveman writings on the wall. We went ahead and saw how many buffalo they killed at what time and took it as fact. Yet, could it be that the human essence of fiction was elaborated upon to where, you know, two buffalo, they might have drawn two buffalo, but yet only they killed one buffalo during that day.
Mm-hmm.
To bring it to current times, we base a lot of our accepted popular culture on shows like CSI or, you know, 24, to where it's relevant, yet it's only based on current events.
Mm-hmm.
So when, Dr. Ken, you went ahead and said that there are editors and we have no clue how many writers there are,
mm-hmm.
How do we decipher between, and the New York Times goes ahead and they turn over 100 different writers, both fiction and nonfiction, every single week.
I want you to answer that when we come back, Ken. How do we know how many writers there were? We'll be back in a moment. Ken, are you a believer in the Antichrist as well?
The text certainly are. Again, I'm a scholar, so I have to hedge or allow a little wiggle room. It is problematical for the Jewish world. I'll say that because, again, how many gods do you have? Do you have one? Do you have two? And who is ultimately in control? Let me give you perhaps a Jewish answer that the Antichrist or Satan or Satan has as much power as you decide to give him. And that's fundamental. because each of us has choice, and that's what it comes down to. And if you choose to relinquish the power that God gave you, then that's how much the enemy will have.
Do you think, though, that the Antichrist, if it exists, is here now?
Has always been here. Always been here. The spirit, as it were, and the New Testament says the same thing. When individuals relinquish their choice to do good and their power to do good and let it go, as it were, then they give themselves over to their own evil inclination. It's human choice to create heaven, to create hell, which unfortunately we do. That spirit of Antichrist, according even to the New Testament, we're going across the religious lines now, it has been around from the beginning and still is.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, sir. Thank you.
All right. My name's Chris. I'm calling from roundabout Mississippi, actually. And my question was referencing to the Gospel of Judas. He had said something about the Watchers in reference to him as the Nephilim.
Yes, the Nephilim.
The Nephilim?
The fallen ones, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that, you know, term tossed around quite a bit, and I was trying to get your input on them possibly being the some aliens from outside of this planet, and what your take would be on that. And Mr. Norrie had a guest on a couple nights ago, and he used the term Nephilim, being a race that had come in and done some genetic experiments that were fleeing from their own people and had some ties to a city of Atlantis. And I was just trying to get your intake on what you would think about that, referencing to the Gospel of Judas.
Yeah, well, up until we have discovered these additional texts and the Gospel of Judas being only one example, the Dead Sea Scrolls as well, all we had were these little tidbits from the book of Genesis, Genesis 5:28. We've got another example where it talks about the Nephilim specifically, and then moves on to the next verse. And you're wondering, what on earth is going on here? Now we fill in the gaps, and we know that we have an ancient tradition. That's all we can say, at least as scholars, that's all we can say. We report, you decide. We've got a tradition of a group of sons of heaven, as they're called, the Watchers. Now, the Bible calls them the sons of God, or the B'nai Elohim. What does that mean? It doesn't tell us. But the Watchers came. They came down by the hundreds. They descended on the summit of Mount Hermon during the days of Yared. And they began to make an oath to themselves in terms of what they would do on this planet. And then we have this ancient tradition of the giants. Now, we have to do with that what we will. I can't tell you that this is not extraterrestrial. I can't tell you that it is either, for certain. But this is certainly tantalizing, and we didn't know about it before.
Yeah, because you was giants as being their offspring, and I know he had a guest, Mr. Norrie had a guest on a couple nights ago talking about the Nephilim doing some genetic experiments on this world. But was giants, we talking about the, you know, the six fingers and toes, two rows of teeth, you know, kind of tall, mean-looking fellas?
All this text talks about is their height.
Uh-oh. Where'd you go there, Ken?
Hmm?
There you are. There you are. You were muffled.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All the text talks about is their height, which we were trying to struggle with before, and from my perspective, could be symbolic. A lot of these things are written in a kind of code. The Dead Sea Scrolls call it the Pesher method, the Pesher technique, where they'll say one thing. Back to our other caller talking about the cavemen and the drawings of the buffalo on the cave. Indeed, we don't know exactly what they intended, and we're putting our finger now on the heart of the scholarly world right now. This is what scholars do. All we have is the text, and then it's up to various interpretations of what it means. Were they really 3,000 cubits tall? The text doesn't say anything about six fingers or toes, anything like that. But it does talk about their incredible height, that they were rapacious in their appetites and devouring humankind. But if this is just total fantasy, if this is just total folklore, then isn't it curious that they came up with it? You know, so much fantasy and folklore, quote-unquote, is really based on something. The story about Troy, for example, and the Trojan horse was dismissed as laughable, as just absurd, for nearly 1,900 years until an archaeologist named Schliemann dug it up around the turn of the 20th century. And now we know there really was a Troy. So we've got this account. Where did it come from? Is it based on something, and could it be extraterrestrial? I give you permission. As a scholar, that's what I can tell you.
Do you think Goliath was real and that Goliath was a giant?
Now, that's interesting, because some have suggested that Goliath, the story of David and Goliath, Goliath might have been one of the offspring of these giants. The Dead Sea Scrolls just happen to weigh in on that exact passage because they have given us an alternate reading of the very verse where Goliath appears. And in traditional Bibles, we're told he comes in at over 9 feet tall. But according to the Dead Sea Scroll version, he comes in at, as I recall, it's 4 cubits and a span, which would be more like 7 feet tall. This is now the oldest version of that story in the world. And many English Bibles on the strength of the Dead Sea Scrolls are being corrected, some with footnotes, saying the earliest manuscripts say around 7 feet tall. So this is certainly within the realm of genetic human possibility without giantism.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, this is Bobby from Reno.
Hi, Bobby.
Hey, it's nice to talk to you, George.
Thank you, sir.
I was going to see if you agree with us. There's a bunch of us on the Internet that think that this is a smear campaign because this is coming out at the same time as the Da Vinci Code, and they're calling it the Gospel of Judas, and who says it's a gospel? But underneath all of this, it's like saying it's like good to betray Jesus or to think that apostasy could be good and all this. And since it's coming from National Geographic, and they're the ones that tried to argue against Charlie Sheen's point when he came out on CNN the other day that National Geographic is part of, like, all what Alex Jones is fighting, and this is some kind of PR campaign. And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, those individuals, of course, Charlie Sheen came out to talk about 9/11. Alex Jones comes on the show quite a bit, Ken, and talks about the New World Order and issues like that. But I guess the caller's basis was, is this real, this Gospel of Judas, or is it a campaign to change something?
I understand that this is going to outrage a lot of people. A lot of sincere folk, a lot of sincere Christians will be very upset, certainly,
yes,
just about the existence of this document. And all I can tell you as a scholar is, from everything I know about scholarship, this document is authentic. I'm not, as a scholar, endorsing it. I'm not saying I bite into everything as we know, I'm a facilitator of interchange. That's what I do. I trot it out there and let you form your own opinion, but I can tell you what the writers thought. The writers were of a Gnostic group who really believed that this Big Bang sent shards of the eternal into all of us. A divine presence, a pleroma, that Adam was one example of an aeon that came forth from the original Big Bang. They started to look at God differently, at human beings differently. They started to look at salvation as a journey of self-discovery. And that ultimately means that there's a divine reason behind everything as part of the self-discovery, and that Judas fit into that, and that Jesus, in order to facilitate salvation for humanity, had to himself be liberated, as it were. This is not my thinking. It's Gnostic thinking. He had to be liberated from his own fleshly body. Didn't he say, I go to prepare a place for you? He knew all along, according to the Gospels, that this was his mission. This was his divine mission. That he couldn't stay in a single fleshly body. He had to explode out of it spiritually and indwell every individual. So to that extent, the Gnostics felt Judas played a role in it. So instead of looking for enemies everywhere, maybe enemies are simply the people that we understand the least.
And did he not, though, while he was being crucified, cry out to God the Father? Why was this being done to him?
In Aramaic, we have in one of the gospel accounts, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that's why have you forsaken me? It's an Aramaic paraphrase of the Hebrew, lama azavtani, why have you left me? Why have you abandoned me? He was entirely human and entirely Jewish, mind you, in his reaction, in his phrases, his utterances, from beginning to end.
Does it sound like a man who had doubt in his mind?
It sounds like a real man. It sounds like a historical man. And that excites a lot of people. Again, Jewish scholars as well as Christian scholars sit down at the same table to discover the historical Jesus. When we have expressions of ancient rabbis who lived in the same day of Jesus, who speak in similar language, now we've got Jesus who's talking like a first century rabbi. As I mentioned, we know more about Jesus historically, Yeshua historically, than we have ever known in two millennia.
Well, the fact that he would say that on the cross, to me, kind of contradicts the Gospel of Judas in that, you know, they were talking about, hey, we've got to do this, I've got to get arrested, I've got to get crucified. Why would you do all that and then feel as if you were being forsaken or left, while you're on the cross?
Okay, there's a lot of mystery involved in the Gnostic mentality, and part of it, part of the sacrifice is feeling abandoned. He had to not only be killed, but he had to feel abandoned. He had to literally go down into the depths, and that was part of the salvific plan itself. Was all foreordained, and that's the idea. And again, I'm not preaching it, not saying you have to bite into this, but we find it from Dead Sea Scrolls to the apocryphal writings to the Gospel of Judas, the same kind of language. Everything is in line. Everything is in order. It's part of this divine plan. So accept it and look for that journey of discovery inside yourself.
Okay, let's go to East of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, you know what, guys? I kind of don't want to believe this, but let's say that Judas's relationship with Jesus, he was like a catalyst to facilitate a death wish that Jesus had. Let's say that Jesus was kind of suicidal, and George, I agree with you about how come on the cross he says that, and then Judas is helping him facilitate his own death.
Right.
Well, and then you just mentioned about feeling abandoned. I'm looking at it like if we all kind of descend in a mindset from Christianity, could this explain things like teen suicide? Like we just want to give up and we feel abandoned, and so, but we do it for a reason that's good. Now I'm not telling anybody out there kill yourself. That's not my point. The thing is that, but psychiatrists are perplexed incredibly by teen suicide. Why does it happen? You know. Let's say that we came from the mindset of Jesus. Well, I go to church, I go to Catholic Mass, and when I take the Eucharist, I'm communing. If I can't believe what I'm doing, you know, like I'm communing with Jesus, I'm hooking up with him, then what am I doing? Why do I do what I do? I know I feel good when I go to church. I do commune with Jesus and God. Is this the reason why sometimes we have suicides? Is because Jesus was suicidal.
Ooh, I wouldn't want to go there.
Would you say it was suicidal? No, either would I.
No, I wouldn't go in that direction with it at all. I think
more of a martyr, I guess.
More of a Martin Luther. I like the Martin Luther King concept in terms of not only Jesus, but of many of the Israelite prophets were Martin Luther King dead on, and so was Jesus. And they knew there were many ancient Israelites who knew that their fate was not terrific. One of these ancient texts is called the Ascension of Isaiah, that actually declares that the prophet Isaiah was himself martyred and knew that this would happen, and he was sawn in two on a tree. Can you imagine? And there's a subtle reference to this in the New Testament book of Hebrews that speaks in chapter 11 of those who were sawn in two. And Christians have been reading this for centuries without realizing this is a reference to one of the banned books about Isaiah, who also had a martyrdom-type experience and ultimately ascended into the heavens, according to this banned book. Which, by the way, you can find in Secrets from the Lost Bible that I wrote.
Okay, I like that. West of the Rockies, you're up with Ken Hansen on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Ken, I have a pretty straightforward question. In the Judas text, is there any mention of Mary Magdalene?
No. You'll find that in the Gospel of Philip. Which is also pretty tantalizing. This is the passage that says that he had a special relationship with Mary Magdalene and that he kissed her on the, and then it's one of these blanks again, one of the holes in the text, and we don't know where he kissed Mary Magdalene. But that is the Gospel of Philip.
Okay, so Judas didn't have anything to say about it then.
Not the Gospel of Judas. It does speak of Judas as a 13th disciple in the Gospel of Judas, and one of our internet writers has asked if the other disciple might not have been, or the beloved disciple might not have been, Mary Magdalene. The Gospel of Judas doesn't weigh in on it, but from my perspective, there were in fact 13, and the 13th was the beloved disciple and was another John, separate from the Galilean fisherman. The fisherman, the son of Zebedee, could not have been the beloved disciple.
Did he ever talk about the Last Supper, Ken? The Judas?
There's a mention in the Judas text of something like a Thanksgiving prayer, but it could also, in fact, be the Eucharist. It speaks of the disciples gathered together. It says they're seated in pious observance. That sounds a bit like the Essenes. They gathered together offering a prayer of thanksgiving, giving over the bread. And so we've got what looks like a Eucharist here. And then it says at that point, Jesus laughed. And it gets very mystical. And they wonder, why are you laughing?
Did you hear those angelic whistles?
Angelic whistles.
You didn't hear those, did you?
Not quite.
Angelic. Anyway, Ken, we're running out of time, but I wanted to thank you for being part of the program. Tell us about the recent book, and where can you get it?
Yeah, I have released yet a second book on the Dead Sea Scrolls called The Essene Book of Everyday Virtues. What would the Essenes tell us if they were here in the 21st century? I've retranslated the best, I think, passages from the scrolls into modern paraphrasistic English. You can get it at your local bookstore or, of course, Amazon.com. Go to my website, treasuresintime.org. And don't forget Secrets from the Lost Bible.
All right, Ken Hansen, thank you so much. Let's keep in touch, my friend, okay?
Definitely. My pleasure.
Fascinating story about the Gospel of Judas. Man, those days. If I had a time machine, I'd go back then. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Nikki Imbrunoni, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.